Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I've got a real treat for us today. I'm going to be speaking to a gentleman, Jim Campos, who was referred to me by a number of people as Mr. Carpinteria. And I think that's a fantastic title. Turns out that Jim has a lot to do with things that are happening on the cultural level in Carpinteria. And there's a story behind this. We talked on the phone about some things that he was studying at the moment. I want to bring that up to Jim. But a little introduction. Jim was born and raised in Carpinteria. He attended Carpinteria schools. His first language is Spanish, and he grew up on the Bonnebaker Ranch. And then his family moved to 9th Street, and that's Hollywood, by the Carpinteria Mexican community. That was Old Town Carpinteria. Anyway, he earned a PhD at UCSB in educational psychology. He had a 35-year career in the Carpinteria Unified School District. Couple of achievements. He established a Title VII preschool program for Spanish-speaking children. Another feather in his cap was that he used the methodology of Dr. Jim Cummins of Ontario Language Institute in Canada, and the final 13 years of his CUSD career, he used Cummins' methodology, which was only a hypothesis at the time, and he took it a next step up. It's now considered a maxim in bilingual language education. Let's see, what else? He wrote the Carpinteria Title VII preschool program in the April issue of the Harvard Educational Review in the 80s. And Maine Elementary School was a California Distinguished School and won awards in computer science, physical education, et cetera. Maine schools' test scores rose for each of his last 8 years leading the school. He was named Santa Barbara County's top elementary principal in 2006, and he won a Crystal Apple Award. In retirement, he joined three other educators to write two pictorial histories of the Carpinteria Valley. He wrote about Carpinteria history, which was exciting. And in 2020, he wrote an entire year of hindsight history on a weekly basis for the Coastal View News. He sits on the Carpinteria Valley Museum of History, the Carpinteria Culture Foundation, and he's a member of the Carpinteria Rotary Morning Club. He was named Carpinteria of the Year in 2025. I think that's fantastic. And we want to talk a little bit about Carpinteria and Jim's interest, especially in the mural project. That to me is a fantastic idea. And I welcome to the program, Jim, Dr. Campos.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm very happy to be here.
So tell me, what was, a dumb question, but when you were growing up in Hollywood of Carpinteria, what was your house like? What was the view out your window?
That's kind of it makes me chuckle. You know, my father, Sal Chava, used to drive the school bus, not the school bus, I'm sorry, the church bus of the Catholic Church, and would take kids to Mount Carmel. In fact, my first 3 years of education were at Mount Carmel, and then I shifted over to the Liceo School and stayed with the Carpinteria schools from there. But he drove the bus once. I don't know if I was first, second, or third grade. And he took it down Hollywood, 9th Street, which was a dead-end street. The rest of 9th Street continues over a bridge and heads all the way out to Linden Avenue. But anyways, he drove the bus down 9th Street, Hollywood, and he got to our home, which he was going to build. And the kids looked at it that were on the bus and they went, "You're going to live there?" Because it looked so bad. It was a wooden stick home of some kind, which my dad was going to rebuild and turn into something, but it looked terrible at the time. And I was very proud of my dad that we were going to build that house. And of course, the kids, "You're going to live there?" Anyways, we had Franklin Creek right in back of that. It paralleled 9th Street. So and the Hollywood name is really a curious thing. You know, how did it come to be called Hollywood? And there were lots of hypotheses about where it came from. My favorite one, or the one I think makes the most sense, is that it was named because there was a Hollywood crew that came in there and were filming a World War I picture. And they used Franklin Creek with the banks on each side, having the soldiers in the creek, and it was kind of shallow, and climbing out of the thing. And that makes the most sense to me. That's where Hollywood came from. But the other one that of various reasons for the name was that all the prettiest Mexican girls lived in Carpinteria, that were in Carpinteria, were in Hollywood. So take your choice, I guess. But I think the actual Hollywood thing with the movie guys that were doing something there makes the most sense to me. Long
How
answer.
Fantastic. That's such a good memory. So what was school like? When did you get up? How did you get to school? What was school like in your day?
Okay. Aliso School was our primary school. And from 9th Street, where we lived, the Hollywood section, we would walk. It was a short walk to Aliso School. Aliso School not only provided our education, it was our baseball field, our basketball courts. We played football. We used 9th Street also to play on the street there. But pretty much Aliso School provided the kind of park that we needed for our play. And so we were constant, whether we were in class or not, we were constantly at the Aliso School.
Okay, so now I also understand that this is something that is very important for you, that this father of, you know, you say Carpinteria Man of the Year, et cetera, 2025. And I want to know more about the conversation, Jim, that you and I were talking about, the importance of August 24th, 1859. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what that involved, I understand there was a petty cow thief in Carpinteria. And I want you to tell me that story. So what happened on August 24th, 1859?
Well, on the evening of, and you know, it's hard to figure out if it was the 23rd or the 24th, because, you'll understand in a couple of seconds why. But there was a group of vigilantes who decided they were going to take out one of the people living in Carpinteria. And they chose a man named Francisco Badillo. And he has a real interesting profile, I guess you want to say, in the history of Santa Barbara County. And there are a lot of people that have not very nice things to say about him on both the California Spanish-speaking side and on the American English-speaking side. But the guy must have been very, very unique. And the vigilantes, I don't think, knew the history behind this man. And so they triggered a real catastrophe crisis in Santa Barbara County. Anyways, on the 23rd or 4th, they mounted seven riders in the middle of the night, traveled probably, I'm going to guess, maybe through Montecito, around the area of the Santa Barbara Polo Field, and continued on into Carpinteria, crossing the streams, the creeks that are numerous in Carpinteria. And they reached Carpinteria Creek, where Badillo had a cabin. And he was living there with three of his sons. He had a slew of kids, and he had three of them with him. One was 16, and the other two were 13 and 11. The seven riders that came in, went to the house, opened the door, pulled Badillo out of his house, dragged him out, him and his 16-year-old son, walked him or dragged him something about 500 varas, and a vara is a little bit shorter than a yard, but I guess, you know, we can consider it a yard so that we have an understanding of how far they traveled. But they pulled him out of the house, which was right on Carpinteria Creek by the 8th Street Bridge today. And they took him to an oak tree, found the branch, threw the rope around it, and they hung both Francisco and his son Eduardo. And the two little kids, the 11 and 13-year-old, somehow must have gotten a glimpse of the riders. And it was a dark night. We looked up the date in 1859 to see what kind of a night it was. Was it a full moon or whatever? It was the sliverest of slivers in the moon. So it must have been extremely dark. But the children obviously were able to make out the riders in some way. Anyway, so they hung Badillo that night. And the kids that they left alone ran to the what was called the Ranchero Resort, where a man named Henry Daly was keeping the house there. And I guess if they were travelers, they might stop there. They might eat there. They might buy some things there. But they, you know, they reported to the man that their father had been killed. And so he pointed them in the direction of Russell Heath. And if you're any kind of historian of Santa Barbara, you know who Russell Heath was, because he was, for a while, he was the sheriff of Santa Barbara County. He also was the district attorney. He was sent to Sacramento for a term of something. Anyways, a big man there who settled in Carpinteria in only 1858. So he had come to Santa Barbara around 1850 and became a big man in the government, and then was living in Carpinteria and was in Carpinteria. Henry Daly sends him in the direction of Russell Heath. Heath takes the report and then immediately gets a message over to the big wigs in Santa Barbara, who in the morning have a party, a posse, travel to Carpinteria and find the bodies hanging from the oak tree. Apparently, the Badillo was only a couple of inches off the ground. And so some of the children later, you know, an anecdote of history, you know, say that if they had only hung him a couple of inches lower, he could have lived. He wouldn't have hung. How could they have done that to our grandfather or something? Anyways, they had an inquiry that morning, and the coroner from Santa Barbara, Dr. James Ord, was there. The mayor of Santa Barbara at the time was Antonio Maria de la Guerra, and so he was present. And a number of riders were there, and a lot of looky-loos who lived in Carpinteria were all there. And I think this is the part that you liked when we were talking yesterday, was that as the inquest is going on, a rider comes by in back of them from the direction of Ventura, heading towards Santa Barbara or Montecito or into Carpinteria. And one of the children yelled out, "Allí va uno de ellos." There goes one of them, one of the ones that had hung our father. And so the five of the men that were at the inquest jumped on their horses, rode out, and started chasing the rider. The rider could have waited for them, but he didn't. He took off. And so there was a chase, and they started shooting their pistols at him, and they hit him five times. They killed the horse. The horse tumbled over, and the rider was discovered to be George Washington Stockton Knightover, who was an interesting person in the Valley of Carpinteria. He was a hunchbacked, kind of deformed guy, and which is why the kids would have, if they would have recognized anybody, they would have recognized that man. And, you know, I think that, you know, if they would have left him at the house and not brought him, you know, to do the dirty work, they probably would have gotten away with this without anybody knowing who had killed Badil. And they hung him, as you mentioned, as a cow thief. He had killed a cow, therefore he had to go. That was code of the Old West. But that was not the code in California. In California, Santa Barbara had a very good justice system and had a legendary judge, Joaquin Carrillo, and who was, history, you know, says was one of the best of the judges in Santa Barbara history, and was well respected and as a fair man. Anyways, in Santa Barbara, killing your neighbor's cow, goat, whatever, stealing a horse, was not a capital crime. You did not kill a man for that. You went to court, you sued the person, and the judge made a determination, or the jury, and you were fined. You know, if you were found guilty, you had to pay up. And that was how that was resolved. But Knightover and his riders, hung him. And so that was more of a, I think, an American kind of Old West kind of a thing. But it was not what you did in California. Anyway, so a lot goes on after that. But the key thing here is that Santa Barbara, almost, the government almost collapses as a result of the killing of this man. And so, as someone who's written a couple of books on Carpinteria, you know, we encountered this story. And it was one of those that, to me, did not make any sense. Why did the Santa Barbara government almost collapse if this guy was just a common cow thief? And it kind of set me on a course of researching as much as I could about this man. And I found a mountain of stuff. And I'll stop with that. But he led an incredible life, actually.
Fantastic. And I'm with Jim Campos, who's Mr. Carpinteria. Don't turn that dial back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm talking with Mr. Carpinteria today, Jim Campos. Actually, he was named Carpinterian of the Year for 2025, and with Stephen Bates, who's been on our program. Stephen just wrote a book about the Rincon area, and it was fascinating. I had a great time interviewing him, especially because his family was so closely involved with that area. And I find out that Jim Campos and Stephen are writing a book with Arcadia again, Arcadia Publishing Company. Francisco Badeo, you said he was a remarkable man. Can you tell me more? How was he remarkable? I mean, well,
he was here in 1812. That's when he came to Santa Barbara. He came as a soldado de cuera, a leatherneck soldier. And so if we can, I guess, make a parallel comparison or something, you know, he would be maybe, you know, in Rome with the emperors, they always had the Praetorian Guard and the protectors of, you know, the emperor, that kind of thing. And they were extremely skilled soldiers. And anyways, the soldados de cuero were something of that nature. And they had skills with weapons in everything from lances to scatter guns, pistols, knives, swords. They were required to have a remuda, a group of horses of about 10 apiece, and they all had to have a mule. Anyways, they in California at the Presidio, you had to have a group of soldados de cuera. In Santa Barbara, there were 50 at the time in 1812. But I think it's very likely that Badillo was one of the leathernecks that protected Santa Barbara in 1818 when a privateer in some places in history, he's called a pirate. In other places, he's called a freedom fighter. And anyways, he came to California and began to raid the coast, starting in Monterey, which he ransacked, and then went to Refugio, ransacked it, and then came to Santa Barbara. But when he came to Santa Barbara, the comandante, Jose de la Guerra, he decided he was going to fight. I'm forgetting the guy's name. He was going to fight, the privateer who had two ships and 200 men. And anyways, Badillo would have been one of the soldiers that would have been in combat against the invaders here. They had a ruse which the comandante came up with, which made the 50 look like they were much larger as you come into the marina underneath City College, where the harbor is today. And anyway, so they did movements and things that made it look like there were a lot of them. And when the privateer said, you know, we're coming in, and De La Guerra said, oh, we've been waiting for you. We'd love to welcome you. Come on in. You know, we're ready for you. And that gave the guy pause. And he, instead of invading Santa Barbara, they decided to move on to San Diego, and they ransacked San Diego. But I have to believe that Badillo was part of that group of soldiers that repulsed the attack through the bluff. And it created a kind of a status for all of those guys that were in that. Now, here's the real interesting part. In 1825, a ship from Mexico, and now Mexico is Mexico. It is no longer Nueva España. It is no longer under the King of Spain. The soldados de cuera were the elite soldiers that protected the presidios for the King of Spain. Okay, but now, 1825, it's Mexico. And Mexico wants to get rid of their, what do you want to call them? They exile certain people that are no goodniks kind of thing. And on this ship in 1825, that is sent to Monterey, capital of California. There are some really bad convicts on their killers. And a lot of them, I think, were probably royalists who probably were on the side of the king who are sent here. But they have no place for them in Mexico. They want to send them to California, which could use a few bodies. And anyways, but Dio is on that ship. Now, how he got to Mexico from being in Santa Barbara, I don't know. But when he gets to Monterey, all of the other, I think there were 16 of them, something like that, prisoners that are being banished to California are set in Monterey, and they're going to put them to fight against the indigenous peoples who were beginning to revolt against the government, maybe the Mexican government, I'm not sure, or the Spanish presidio soldiers, whatever. But all of the prisoners stayed in Monterey except Badillo. Badillo was immediately recalled to Santa Barbara. You know, so you have to ask yourself, why was this particular prisoner sent to Santa Barbara? And I have to believe that it was the incident in 1818 that did that, and the friendship with the Comandante de la Guerra. And so he arrives back into Santa Barbara, and I can tell you a whole bunch of other things that he does, which are very interesting. But I don't think that the people that killed him had any idea basically who they were dealing with. This is a man that owned property in Carpinteria, owned property in San Luis Obispo, owned property in Santa Barbara, had a bar in Santa Barbara that he ran. I mean, he had a lot of things that he had done. He was extremely tight with the delegates. Anyways,
Oh, I think that's fascinating. So can you tell me the link to the Nidecker family? Can you explain more about that?
Yes. In 1855, I think, 1805 or 1856, whatever date it was in the Santa Barbara Gazette. And Santa Barbara Gazette was published from about 1854 or 5 till 1856 or 7. And then it began to publish in 1859 in San Francisco. So it wasn't in Santa Barbara anymore. But anyways, in one of those early editions, there was an article there that told that John Marion Nidever, who, by the way, was the brother of George Nidever, the very famous George, who found the Lady of the Island of the Dolphins, which is so, you know, famous. All fourth grade kids read it. Anyways, he was the brother of this guy. Anyways, John Marion Nidever ran for city council in Santa Barbara, which was called the Ayuntamiento. And he actually won in the election to sit on the board, on the council. And the mayor at the time was Pablo de la Guerra, brother of Antonio Maria. And Pablo is, I think, the most famous of all the de la Guerras. He was on the group that wrote the Constitution of California, which allowed them to become a state. He was one of three or four of the Californios that sat in with all the other Americans that wrote it. And anyways, Pablo decided that John Marion Nidever was not qualified to sit on the council. I don't know what the reasoning was, but it's right there in the paper. And so you have to assume, never assume, but you have to assume that there must have been some bad blood that existed between Nidever and De la Guerra. And Badillo is one of the strongest supporters of the De la Guerras that existed. He's almost family to the De la Guerras. And there was a OK Corral kind of a fight in 1853 in Santa Barbara. And that is a whole, I've written about that one. And it's been published. But in it, Badil was 67 years old at the time, okay? And he was ferocious. And in this battle, I think he killed one of the people that was in the Irish group of Jack Powers, if you know that part of Santa Barbara's history. And
did you say that again? He was in the what group?
Jack Powers. Do you know that name?
Well, you said something about the Irish group?
Yeah, the Irish had a regiment that was stationed in Santa Barbara during the Bear Flag Republic revolt. And anyways, the Irish troop, Stevenson's regiment, which came into California, was stationed in Santa Barbara. So there was a lot of Irish here, and they were integrated pretty well. But there were certain disputes of land that they wanted to, what's the word? You just sit on the land and you...
Squatter.
Squatter, yeah. He was squatting on the land there by Henry's Beach. And the Den family in the hills, which are very famous to Santa Barbara, were opposed to them being there. And the Delagueros probably sided with Den, and they wanted Powers out. And anyways, there was a confrontation in 1853, I think it was April 30th. The thing escalated, and it became a gun battle. And I think Badil killed one of the men of Powers, and the papers in the North talk about a Spaniard who was, pretty formidable. I think it was Badil. Anyways, so even at 67, those Soldado de Cuero skills and whatever must have been in place. And so I kind of think that Night Ever probably targeted Badil because he moved to Carpinteria, and I think things were getting hot. And he moved himself out of Santa Barbara, kept his family on State Street. And so his wife was tending to the children and the whole thing. And Badil isolated himself in Carpinteria. And so I think that despite the fact that he was stealing his neighbor's cows, he was doing that. There are papers in court where the Rodriguez family sues him for stealing one of their cows. Well, he steals the cows, butchers them, and eats them. Anyways, he probably did that to Night Ever too, but Night Ever, I think it was probably an assassination. I can't prove that, but I think that there is a link there. So,
I have to ask. So, when we were talking the other day about this topic, you mentioned that this was a sort of a demarcation between the Ranchero days and then what follows after. And so I'm wondering, can you pinpoint a date, and could you also tell us why you feel that this is this conflict with Badil and Night Ever? Can you tell us why you think that marks a certain line in the sand?
Yes. Stephen Bates, who's been on your show, I think a number of times, and I are working on this. And Stephen, who is just a A1 digger, I mean, he can find anything, found the deed that Francisco Badillo's wife, Rafaela Garcia de Badil, handed over to Stephen H. Homestead on April 20th, 1860. So that's only 6 months after the lynching. And so she turns over all of Badillo's land to Homestead. And Homestead is an environmentalist. He is a farmer, and he loves the landscapes and the art colony that they formed in Santa Barbara and Carp, and becomes a big figure in Carpinteria and changing it from a livestock valley into a farming and, again, very environmentally conscious place. And so also 2 years after 1860, there is a drought that lasts for 20 years in Santa Barbara County and kills all the livestock. And so you see that at the point of the killing of the deal, there is a transfer of the land to a man that is not a ranchero, that is not tending with goats, chickens, cows, pigs, and horses. And you see...
And you're talking about Amstead. He's not a ranchero.
No. And why, you know, why does Senora Badillo sell to somebody that is so different to the culture that was in Carpinteria and Santa Barbara? She does the exact opposite. There's also an incident where Nightever went to the home of Mrs. Badillo in Santa Barbara. She lived on the corner of Canyon Perdido and State Street. So you can kind of figure where that is in your head. And he confronted her. He was with one of the writers, I think a McKeon. I don't know what in the world he would have been doing wanting to talk to Mrs. Badillo. But Mrs. Badillo got really irate with him. And they got into a huge verbal exchange. And she had her oldest son with her. I can't remember his... Oh, Felipe. His name was Felipe. He was 25 years old at the time. And it got violent. Not physically, but they had to call in a justice of the peace to break them up. And I remember, they're living right in back or in front of the Presidio. So there would have been a justice of the peace nearby who broke up the thing and kept it from escalating. Nightever wanted them arrested because they had been rude to him. Anyways, I wonder if perhaps he may have had the gall to try to buy the land from Mrs. Badillo. Why else would he have gone over there after killing her husband? It just doesn't, you know, make a whole lot of sense.
Exactly. So, how much land are we talking about?
It was 100 acres off of the Carpinteria Creek, of which Olmsted almost immediately bought 400 more. So he owned everything of the Carpinteria State Park, went all the way to Linden Avenue, went all the way to 192 and Linden and Casitas Road. So he had quite a bit of land. And it's at that point that the Americans really begin to take over in Carpinteria. And, you know, I often ask myself, why did the Californios who owned the land give it up? And they would have given it up because of the drought and the deaths of all the livestock. They couldn't do it anymore. But the farmers could. With all of the, I forget what you call the land that has the underground wells under it, but they were able, you know, to punch holes down and create artesian streams or that would jump out and that kind of thing. So they could do a lot of farming with the ground kind of crops. And so crops in Carpinteria initially are the lima beans, which Carpinteria becomes the number one place in the United States for lima beans, with the Fish family, the Browns, and Olmsted, and all of that, and Heath as well. But anyways, Carpinteria completely changes. And I think it's very interesting that if you look at Santa Barbara, with all of the street names, which are all named after the people that live there, the Codas, the Carrillos, the Delagueras, every street has the name of one of the Californios that was there. In Carpinteria, they start selling it all off. It's all bought by the Americans. And today, there is one Spanish surname street in Carpinteria, one total. I mean, I think that is just amazing to me. It is Alvarado Street, which is a very short street at the top of Linden at 192 at Foothill. And that's it. You know, and I think that's telling us something there. But anyways, 1859-60 is a point of demarcation where the ranchero era ends in Carpinteria, at least, and probably throughout Santa Barbara County, I think. And it becomes now, Los Americanos have taken over. So that's what we're kind of, Stephen and I are kind of going to look at that.
I think that's fascinating. And Richard's telling us we got to go to quick break. But when we get back from the break, I want you to characterize, if you can, Jim, the lifestyle changes. So between the Californios and the Rancho days, and then the American Los Americanos, that characterize that for us, how that changed in Carpinteria, and maybe even Santa Barbara too. Hey, Richard, let's go to quick break. Get back from the break. I have to say, this is a fascinating conversation about the history of Carpinteria. We've gone back to 1820. Fantastic. And I'm with Jim Campos, who's Mr. Carpinteria. I can't wait to hear what he says about the difference between the California way of life and the Americano way of life. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm talking with Mr. Carpinteria today, Jim Campos. Actually, he was named Carpinterian of the Year for 2025, and with Stephen Bates, who's been on our program. Stephen just wrote a book about the Rincon area, and it was fascinating. I had a great time interviewing him, especially because his family was so closely involved with that area. And I find out that Jim Campos and Stephen are writing a book with Arcadia again, Arcadia Publishing Company, talking about Carpinteria. And this is great because Carpinteria, it's such an individual kind of place. And, you know, Carpinteria is not Santa Barbara, et cetera. So I want to talk a little bit about the lifestyle changes. I mean, we talked in the first segment about 1859, where there was a hanging of a gentleman, Francisco Badeo, for running off with a cow. And so he was hung by a number of people, not the least of which was the Nydever family, George Washington Stockton Nydever, and involved was Judge Carrillo, Mr. La Guerra, et cetera. So it was, that was the life. Now, Jim is telling us that it was that Mr. Olmsted was going to Mrs. Badeo's house in Santa Barbara and asking for the land. She had 100 acres after her husband died. And so Jim was positing this thought, which is, why would you go to the house of someone whose husband you killed? What would be the motivation?
Hang on. Yeah, Elizabeth, Nydever's the one that went to the house. I don't know what he, I suspect he was interested in the land. It was the wife who went to Olmsted and sold the
land. I got it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So characterize the difference. What would be the difference in lifestyle? We have the period 1859 to 1860. And that's where we're talking right around that era.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The ranchero days were obviously, the vaqueros out with the cows and the horses and a very pastoral way of life. Carpinteria was considered one of the pueblo lands of Santa Barbara, and pueblo lands because Santa Barbara was a pueblo. You know, it will become a city with statehood in 1850. But Carpinteria served as like a livery stable to Santa Barbara, and so the livestock was here. And probably also, it was the same relationship, I would think, in North County as well. But anyway, so Carpinteria served as the Pueblo lands, and it provided then the places where they raised their cows. And when the gold rush hit in 48, the cattle herds were being driven to the gold fields to sell, and they were getting rich, with that. But the women that lived in the valley, they liked their gardens and things like that. But it really wasn't a farming, agricultural community. So there was a difference in lifestyle in that way. Also, is that there was no education. There weren't any schools. Here's an incident that I read in a book, and I just loved it, where one of the Californias was watching a little boy who had a sandwich in Santa Barbara. And that boy took his sandwich and he traded it for a copy of the Santa Barbara Gazette. And one of the Californios, noting this, said, "They're going to eat us alive. Look at the way that kid just gave away his sandwich so he could read a newspaper." Well, the people that were literate in Spanish or English or whatever in Santa Barbara County and in California were a real small percentage. And when the Americans came in, I mean, they were very much into their literacies, skills and such, and schools. And so you didn't have that with the California culture either,
Do you mean literacy? In California culture, there's not a lot of literacy.
No, they even recognize it. They said, "It's always sunny here." In fact, some of the Americans that wrote in their diaries and said, "God, it is so easy to just fall back into this lifestyle and get and the leisure times that are available to us, that we don't have to, depend on these other these skills that require education." And the guys that were in power of the Californios to educate their kids, they would send them to Chile. And so, like, the De La Guerra kids were all educated in Chile. And so they, they'd get educated there, learn to read, write, and then come back and keep, the higher offices in California. But with the Americans, they brought in a whole, different mindset. And again, they recognize it is pretty easy to get sucked in to the sunny days, the beach, and all of that. When Olmsted buys the land and takes a big chunk of it, and I would think begins to encourage other people with farming kinds of interest to come in, that starts happening about 1868 or so. You begin to see people like the Baylards, start blanking here. I know so many of these names. Henry, what's the great artist from here? Chapman Ford. Henry Chapman Ford, who is one of the big artists of the era, he lives with Olmsted. He lives on the Olmsted homestead and stays there for a number of years before moving to Santa Barbara. And I think Ford is one of the originators of the societies for environment, whatever, in Santa Barbara. And anyways, Carpinteria becomes a big part of that movement. And Russell Heath, who I've mentioned a couple of times, he has one of the monuments in Carpinteria still, his house, a great big mansion that was built over an adobe. And the remains still are at Eucalyptus Street in Carpinteria. And so you can visit it and you can see a little piece of the adobe and a little piece of the mansion. But it was a magnificent mansion, and that was where some of the gatherings were to these people who were interested in, you know, making Carpinteria a really beautiful place. But with the drought, kills all the livestock, the California selling everything off, the Americans taking over, basically, and very few Californios left at the turn of the century. There were less than 100 of them in the entire Carpinteria Valley. And they do come back because farming booms and they need labor. And so the natural labor was to go back to the Spanish speakers, and probably the Spanish speakers start bringing the relatives back into Carpinteria, and you have a great big immigration trend into Carpinteria. And so the Spanish speaking population gets revived.
So tell me the dates then, Jim. So we have the statehood 1850, then we have the petering away of the lifestyle of the Californios 1860s or so. And then we have
going forward. And also remember, the Civil War is going on in 1860. And the Civil War ends in 1865. And a lot of the Southerners start coming to California. And they came to Carpinteria. And anyways, there is the Southern Belles and all that. They weren't ready to start, tilling the land, growing the food, crops, and all of that. And so you get a real interesting mix of people. You have the original guys like the Olmsteads and some of those that are coming from New York and parts of the North. And then you have the Southerners that are coming in that are not used to doing the labor, and now they've got to do it. And then you've got the Californios, and the Californios are counted on because they know the land better than anybody. And so they, you know, they all work together. But I think, again, the Californios start selling the land off because it's not matching the ranchero lifestyle that was there before. And by the end of the 19th century, the 20th century is starting, it now is an American community. And so I think that's where we wanted to get, right?
Okay, so the largest rancho that, you know, here's Carpinteria. What was the main rancho of Carpinteria area?
That would be the Rancho El Rincón. And that was Teodoro Arellanes, who got a league of land. I can't remember I can see how big it is. But he wanted two leagues. They only allowed him one. And so I know you've heard that the Californians had a hard time retaining their land grants and things. And so Arellanes fought for a long time. After his death, they kept fighting to keep the Rancho El Rincón as one big chunk. And eventually his daughter married I forget the name, but it began to split up, and so you got a lot of people coming in then, dividing up the Rancho El Rincón and the other pieces that had been owned by other Californios. Now, did I kind of wander off too far? I'm not sure.
No, that's what I was asking. Is the Californios, the lifestyle changes, and then, you know, before we have to say goodbye, I would love to hear Californios marrying, wedding,
yeah,
Americanos in, yes, Carpinteria. And can you tell me the story of maybe two?
Yeah, but, or vice versa. I mean, the Rodriguez family, very, very big family in Santa Barbara. And she lived right next, what was her first name? Rodriguez. Oh, I'm blanking. Anyways, the Rodriguez lady, the matriarch of that family, was a key person that negotiated with John Fremont when Fremont came in with his, you know, troops, and they took Santa Barbara, she negotiated with him and made sure that it was not going to be a bloody kind of a sacking of Santa Barbara. And so she negotiated the peace. Anyways, the Rodriguez family in Carpinteria, they had chunks of land there too. One of her sons, Juan Jose, I think, Rodriguez, married into an Anglo family. And so he had a, I'm blanking on the names and things. I can see the lady's face. She's in one of our books. We put her photograph there. But he married one of the English speakers. And so the mixed marriages, there were a whole bunch of them. And I think, you know, so it wasn't just the Americans marrying some of the Latina ladies, but the same, the Latino guys marrying the American ladies too. It was something that was done. And so anyways, Rodriguez is one. I should know a whole bunch of others, but I'm blanking on you, and I apologize.
So what was the social status? I mean, were the Americanos equal in status to the Californios?
No. And in 1859, when Santa Barbara almost collapses, you know, the government almost falls, they send in James Carleton. I think he was a captain or a lieutenant, with a bunch of dragoons from Fort Tejon to quell the tense situation in Santa Barbara. And the first thing that Carleton did when he got here was he wrote an incredible document about what he found here. And one of the things was there were no Chumash. The Chumash were down to what he said, a sickly looking group of about 40. He said they were of no consequence at that point in time. And he also mentioned that the Americans that were here, and they were outnumbered 4-1. And he said, they have no tolerance for the ways of the Californios. The rights that they want to give themselves, they do not want to give to the Californios. And that's written down. You can see it. This is from Carleton himself. And he said, these people, the Californios and the Americans that are here, have to learn that they are one now. They are American citizens, both. And so something's got to give, and they're going to have to start working together, because this isn't going to work, you know, with them at each other.
So they didn't get along, really.
Well, not as famously as, you know, some people have sometimes written. But the people that were in the government in Santa Barbara, they brought in a lot of the Americans to work with them. And that is why you have Heath having all of these positions of power. That's why you have Charles, the real famous judge that sat along with Carrillo. I can't think of his name right now. But they brought in a lot of guys that were English speakers who mixed with the others. So it was a joint kind of a thing. But it got hot enough in 1859 with the death of Badillo that it almost collapsed. And as I say, Carleton wrote about it, and he said, hey, you guys are the same. You've got to get it together, you know. In Carpinteria, it eventually gets that way. But, you know, we have a number of trial periods with the immigration trends that come in. I mean, we had segregated schools here in Carpinteria from the 1920s up to 1947. I'm the child of one of the kids that was sent to the Mexican-only school, the Aliso school. You know, so, but, you know, it all worked itself out. One of the things, and I don't know how much longer I have to go, but I have to say this, especially with the monument that we're putting up, that we hope to put up, is that what we have learned is that carpentarians help carpentarians. And so from the Japanese that were here and got interred in the 1940s, you know, all and the Mexicans and the Italians, the Dust Bowlers, all of them worked together. It wasn't just one group doing everything. After, particularly after World War II, there was kind of a coming to Jesus moment or whatever, where everybody gets together and begins to work together. And so you see the memorial football field for the Carpinteria Warriors being built by all of the groups. You know, the Japanese bringing in their machines, and the Dust Bowlers, too, were very much into their tractors and things like that. All of them, you know, raising the land and putting everything together, putting in the electricity, all that stuff came from all corners of Carpinteria. So the football field, the memorial building today that serves as a place that meetings and things occur. In fact, the first Aliso school was there, but that building too is a part of that. The Thunder Bowl racetrack, which was from about 1947 to 57, that was all built by all of the people coming together. And anyways, it's not just one group. It's all the groups working together. And that's what our message is with the monument. We want to have all of the groups honored. And then our 10th panel, our 10th mural, 10 murals, we want it to be a kind of a meld where everybody comes together. And if you're a Carpinterian, Carpinterians help Carpinterians. It's our birthright.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate this. It's not only is it fascinating, but, you know, to differentiate Carpinteria from Santa Barbara also is important. So that this has been so enlightening. And so we say goodbye, but I want to have you on again, especially with Stephen, as the book kind of comes to fruition.
What we want to do is make a movie or a video out of it. And I mean, we are obviously going to have a lot of written stuff, and maybe it will be a book, who knows? But we want to bring it to life in a format that is very accessible to everybody, and maybe we'll be able to put it in our museum if our director is game.
Fantastic! And dear listeners, if you got any ideas how to make this come to life, get in touch with us. And Jim, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth.